Welcome to the Slash Filmcast After Dark, the after show for the Slash Filmcast, where we talk about a variety of random topics that didn't make it into the show. This week, joining me, Devendra, and Jeff Cannata is Drew McWeeny from the Formerly Dangerous newsletter. Drew, thanks for sticking around for the After Dark this week. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So you can check out Drew's newsletter at drewmcweeny.substack.com, and I'd highly recommend it. And you are checking this episode out because you're a subscriber to Patreon at patreon.com/filmpodcast.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of our patrons for making episodes like this possible. Drew, before we dive into our main topic for this After Dark, which is a discussion of Derek Delgadio's In and of Itself that's available right now on Hulu, I have been reading with great interest your Nothing But Star Wars series on the Formerly Dangerous newsletter. And I think it's really interesting. And there's just a couple of things I wanted to highlight about this, about your writing that I just thought was, I want to share with our listeners, with the guys on the podcast. In your first entry, you brought up this great idea that I don't know if you invented this, but you know, it's certainly something that I really appreciate you writing about memorably. So I'm reading from Drew's series at Formerly Dangerous, and this is about Star Wars. And you write, quote, about like what Star Wars has evolved into, right? And like with Dave Filoni and The Mandalorian. And you used a phrase called distant mountains. You said what Dave Filoni seems to understand that confounded J.J. Abrams on this trilogy is the idea of the distant mountains and how to deploy them. I'm talking about something you do when you're building a fantasy world like this. You can have a character refer to some distant mountains without making your audience an explicit promise that you're going to go there. The best example was in the original 1977 Star Wars when Alec Guinness dropped that reference to the Clone Wars. He moved on like it was something that everyone would understand, and in doing so, he lit a fire in an entire generation's imagination. When you do it well, you drop just enough narrative crumbs for the audience to find plenty of room to imagine what they want. End quote. Drew, I didn't tell you I was going to read from your newsletter on the air, but I hope,
Thank you. I hope you don't mind.
Yeah. Your whole series, like really, if I'm to take the main components of the series, is like expressing your disappointment with The Rise of Skywalker, which is a movie that it sounds like you hated. And I want to ask you about like distant mountains. Like, can you expand on that idea a little bit more when it comes to Rise of Skywalker?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think here's, and I'm going to eventually connect these dots, but I think the distant mountains idea is almost at direct odds with the mystery box idea. The original Star Wars in 77 drops plenty of narrative hints as to a larger world without ever saying that any of this is going to be important or urgent or that we're going to necessarily see it. It is simply part of the texture of the world. And I've always said that one of the things that makes Mark Hamill's performance in the original so powerful and so perfect is that he believes every prop and every piece of costuming and every vehicle and every button completely. Whether you know what it is, whether it's ever explained what it is, Mark Hamill believes it all works and he believes it's all real and he sells it completely as real. And I think that he just lives in this world and the world itself is suggested outside the larger. And then, of course, the Star Wars series and the larger universe begins to fill in more and more of those details, and George Lucas himself filled in more and more of those details, and I think had a specific story that he eventually wanted to tell. But I don't think he, at the beginning, had all those details figured out, and I don't think you have to in this kind of storytelling. But I do think you have to have some sense of it. And I think J.J. Abrams, unfortunately, by beginning and ending this trilogy, but not participating in the middle of it at all, and by not playing the rules of Exquisite Corpse properly, Abrams basically set up a lot of ideas, went, what do you think? Ryan Johnson answered all the questions and went, okay, here's a whole lot of new stuff. What do you think? And JJ went, no.
Exactly.
It's the biggest. Yeah. The whole thing is supposed to be yes and. When you're playing these games, right, it's supposed to be yes and. As a storyteller, here's everything I did. Now you pick that up and run with it. Okay, cool. JJ went, no, but. Mm-hmm. And it's really confounding. It is a weird reclaiming of a story too late to reclaim it. And he introduces stuff in the strangest fashions. I think the movie is broken literally from the opening crawl. A voice of the voice of the dead has been heard. Really? Can I see that? That would have been an amazing moment. Can you picture the moment if they had actually, and of course I understand why this moment isn't on film, but can you picture the moment of Leia hearing Palpatine's voice for the first time and realizing, Jesus Christ, he's alive. Can you imagine Han Solo hearing that voice or Luke Skywalker hearing that voice and actually having it land on us? Can you imagine any character hearing it for the first time on screen and having it mean something rather than it's told that it happened between movies? And then they try to play it as a surprise in the next scene. The entire film is like that. It's full of weird stutters and it's full of narrative dead ends. And it is one of the strangest constructed films I've ever seen. And it is a textbook example of why, if you're going to build a trilogy and you know you're going to get to film three, there was never any question they were getting to film three. This wasn't Divergent. This wasn't a thing where it's like, maybe we'll get to the, no, come on. You knew you were going to get to the third one. So build it properly. And the mystery box doesn't work in this case. It's the wrong narrative shape for a Star Wars trilogy. Palpatine should have been the threat from the beginning of this thing, vaguely in the background as he was in The Phantom Menace, if you're really going to echo Lucas's construction. I get the whole mirrored idea. I get the idea of mirrored structure, and I get that that is something that they all talk about. I don't think it's a particularly mirrored trilogy. I think the biggest example of how this is, the third film is working so hard to try to land a plane that it's never seen the control panel of before, is the entire thing they do with Rey and Kylo and the entire notion of a dyad. I'm sorry. What?
I still don't know what that is.
I'm sorry. Excuse me. What? Yeah. You want to introduce that to me maybe before the last 17 minutes of the trilogy as a concept? Maybe? Unbelievable. And it's really, truly poor writing and construction before anything else. And there's so much design work that's beautiful, and the cast is great. And there's a scene, I'm literally writing about this afternoon, this first scene in the movie between Poe and Rey. He gets off the Millennium Falcon and it's on fire, and she comes up with his dented robot, and they bicker and they argue, and it's supposed to be kind of 30s screwball, and oh, look at the energy, and Oscar Isaac is charming, and Daisy Ridley is charming, and oh, they're sassy together, and there's no relationship that we've seen in this trilogy. There's zero screen time that they spent together other than literally shaking hands at the end of the last film going, oh, you're Poe? Yeah, hi, I'm Rey. Cool. We've never met before right now. And then suddenly we're supposed to have this feeling that all these adventures have happened. All of that would have been important to see. All of those emotional connections were legitimately built in the original trilogy, and they're taken as shorthand in this trilogy. And it's a shame. They fail so many good actors. They fail Boyega. They fail Oscar Isaac utterly. Mm-hmm. They fail Daisy Ridley, frankly. This third film, she is a non-entity, and it's because they wrote themselves into a corner and had no idea how to write their way out.
That's what's so baffling to me about this whole thing. I feel like you could throw a rock anywhere in America and hit somebody and ask them, how do you make three new Star Wars movies? And they go, well, you plan all three and you go A, B, C. You know, you go, well, you figure out where you're going to start and where you're going to end, and then you make them.
Hey, guys, we have Lawrence Kasdan in the room. What do you say we just knock out at least three treatments? Just a few rough ideas.
Just an outline. Yeah. Meh. Just give me a starting point and an ending point, and we'll figure out how to get from A to B.
Yeah, call it a working lunch, you know?
The idea that you set out to make a new trilogy of movies – and you just make one at a time with different people doing whatever the fuck they want. It's utterly baffling to me. I honestly spent a long time actively not believing that that could have been the way that they did it.
Yeah. Here's the thing. I ultimately, the marketing phrase that they leaned on so heavily before they released Rise of Skywalker, this is the conclusion of the Skywalker saga. Mm-hmm. No, that ended in 19... Or it ended in 2005, frankly. I think the Lucas version of the Skywalker saga was six films, and it works, man. It tells the story. It tells enough of the story. This really is supposed to be the generational baton handing down, and it's not the end of the Skywalker saga. That's a weird thing to call it, considering Luke Skywalker's in one film. and nobody else in these movies is legitimately a Skywalker. It's a bizarre marketing hook that they tried to sell this as, and it's not. It's the beginning of all of the new Star Wars that they're going to be making, and they should have treated it as such. Mm-hmm. Really, they blew themselves up. They disrespected Boyega, and it's a huge problem because that guy's a movie star. That guy is a guy mm-hmm. you make an investment in. He has an active fan base that's only going to get bigger the longer he's in movies. And you want him to come back and play that character for the next 35 years. You want him to do, you want to make sure that there's plenty of room for him to come. And they burned him to the ground. They made him so feel so marginalized and so disrespected. And what an insane choice. What an insane corporate choice. Not even a creative choice. What a crazy corporate choice.
Yeah.
Interesting to hear Boyega's reaction to the whole thing as well, though. Like, he doesn't harbor any ill will to J.J. Abrams, according to interviews that he's been in. It sounds like just the circumstances under which the movie was made were suboptimal.
And he gets the China thing. Unfortunately, any black celebrity, any actor who really has had to get into how international financing work, if you are a black actor, if you are an actor of any other race other than white, you're going to be told at some point that there's a cap to the international marketplace as far as your value is concerned. And it is an ugly, mm-hmm. nasty, despicable thing that studios lean into. And it's the reason they make choices about what characters can kiss on screen. It's the reason they make choices about how they cast people. It's the reason they decide who can be what role and stuff. And they all do it, and they all still do it. All the conversations about diversity, all the lip service we've given it, and it's still largely these choices boil down to, can it play in China? A market that, frankly, it's insane we coddle politically.
Right, right. Yeah, well, there's a kind of a lot going on there right now, too. It just seems like weird how a lot of companies are tiptoeing around China and what's happening and not really talking about the concentration camps or anything. So yeah. That's
and it's
that's
like something. It's like, how about you just make the film, and then if China doesn't play it, it's China. It's okay. They play like four things a year anyway. It's a weird thing that they're all trying to be one of those four films, and they'll ruin movies and they'll really disrespect talent in order to make that happen.
Yeah.
My question for you, Drew, by the way, is like, we know also that Colin Trevorrow was supposed to do the third movie, right? And he was, axed kind of before things really kicked off. But I do think it maybe gave J.J. Abrams less time than usual to
complete 100%,
a big movie like this, right?
That's the biggest problem with release date filmmaking. When you mm-hmm. are locked into release dates because of marketing and because of your publicity campaigns and because of your toy tie-ins and because all of your production partners have to have things out at certain dates, it can be deadly. And I think they set way too aggressive a schedule for this trilogy. Three years per Star Wars film. Three. That was what Lucas did, and dude, he needed all 3 years. All of those are still held together by tears and band-aids. Like, you still get the feeling that you look at Return of the Jedi, and it's just dudes basically holding the frames together while George Lucas weeps in the background. Like, he never had enough time, but 3 years at least gave him some time to think about them and digest what the audience had just seen and what they reacted to. And at least that was a reactive process where Lucas listened to fan reactions to Star Wars and then went and made Empire Strikes Back. He didn't mm-hmm. do it for them, but he definitely heard what people said. And the same thing between Empire and Jedi. Like, there was a real moment where he could digest people's reactions to the Vader reveal and to the Yoda stuff. And he was like, okay, cool. And then chewed on that and made the next film. When you're making them the way they make these Star Wars films, you're constantly, you have a gun to your head, and you're making choices very impulsively and very quickly. And I think it's why some of these films have been fun and cool. And really the weird Star Wars films off to the side, like Rogue One, kind of had less spotlight on them and a little bit more room to fail and experiment and test screen and tinker. And it's one of the reasons that film works.
So, I'll just say, first of all, if you're interested in reading Drew's writing about this, check out his newsletter, Formerly Dangerous. Reading this newsletter was like, how would I compare this to? It's like, Rise of Skywalker was heartbreaking to me. It was
I
was so looking forward to it, and it was really disappointing how it all turned out. You know, it felt like decades of my life were building to this movie, and they dropped the ball. But that's okay. You know, I know some people like it, including people who listen to this podcast and who have been guests on the podcast. But I think that it's like reading your writing on this, Drew, is like reading someone describe like the time I got my heart broken in middle school in detail, you know, like, and it's just like, wow, this is a really illuminating trip down memory lane, but boy, is it painful. Like you're reminding me of all the things that didn't work about this movie. Like
right.
The Princess Leia or General Leia in the last film. And just like, it just like did not work at all. And I think like maybe at the time I tried to convince myself that it was okay. But like when you look back on it, it just really didn't work. And the original sin of The Force Awakens was like that the Empire rose again and there was really no explanation for it. I mean, maybe in the graphic novels and all the other stuff that happened off screen, but like, what is even happening in the galaxy at this point in time? What were the political dynamics? Like, that's all ignored. Yeah. Let me ask you this question, Jeff Cannata.
I was just going to say, yeah. I think I harbor more frustration with The Force Awakens than I do, honestly. I mean, I think other than just exquisite casting, the way that sort of cookie cutter follows A New Hope or attempts to, and its lack of any kind of boldness or spine or spark of life. I mean, there's a spark of life just in the fact that J.J. Abrams can cast. He knows how to pick people who are watchable. Well,
there's fun action.
Watchable.
There's great moments in the movie. Yeah. You know, like
he knows how to kick off stories. Like that is his specialty.
Ray grabbing the lightsaber and all that. Like that stuff was all pretty cool. I thought there was like some great.
I would say the introduction of Ray and where she lives inside an old speeder that's been abandoned at the edge of it. If that doesn't, that was the very first thing I saw a year and a half before the film came out as just production art. Somebody leaked some stuff to me. And that first image, I was like, oh my God, I think they might do it. Like, that's so great. That is exactly what I love about Star Wars is the notion that there's history and there's weight. And the film isn't that. There's little bits and pieces. I think the real original sin of this trilogy is that perversely, and I understand you want to create some mystery, but perversely, his decision to never let us have even a scene with the original trilogy cast together is just cold. It really breaks some fundamental thing in this trilogy that you can't put right. And that's why I say it can't be the end of the Skywalker saga, because it's not. They don't ever do that. They never give you a resolution that in any way pays off the emotional investment of the old school fans. We really do feel like background, and that's okay. If that had been the sit and what they were telling us it was, they really wanted it both ways here. They wanted to use our love of this and our connection to all the iconography, but they also want to reboot it so that it can last another 30 years. And this weird middle ground, which Hollywood still is wrestling with on all sorts of series, is a very strange choice and a very hard one to thread correctly.
Yeah, I mean, it was never going to be, you know, spoilers for the new trilogy, but like Han dies in the first one, right? And like Luke dies in the second one. So maybe Luke wasn't going to die in the second one, but there was no way they were all going to be reunited, even just starting with the first one. So it is a loss. But anyway, I think the series is fascinating, Drew. You're doing a great job. People should check it out.
Thanks, man.
Let's talk about main topic for tonight, Derek Delgadio's In and of Itself. So we've already recommended during the main show that you watch this. So go watch it. And we are going to spoil the whole thing. I cannot emphasize enough, you should not listen unless you've watched Derek Delgadio's In and of Itself on Hulu. So like, go watch it. Don't listen to this until you've watched it. Let's talk about this as though we have full spoilers. So Jeff, I want to start with you because you're like, you're staking your whole reputation on this. On this show.
Yeah, right? I'll just say, first of all, in the last, I don't know, 48 hours since I made that claim on Twitter and just, you know, I made an impassioned plea to folks to check it out, the responses that I've been getting are incredible. And I'm so happy. I'll read one of them. This is a tweet that I got. Hi, Jeff. I've enjoyed a great deal of what you've done ever since the Totally Rad Show days, but your recommendation of In and of Itself may be that for which I'm most grateful.
Wow.
It goes on from there.
So they've been listening for like a decade, right?
And 15 years. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So it's hard for me to even know where to start with this, but I will say that In and of Itself, it represents why I like art. Like it is a work that I aspire to as a creator. It is a work that I am and totally in love with as a fan, as an observer. It does all of the things that I like. I mean, it is theatrical. It is personal. It is beautiful. It is aspirational. It is magical. I mean, magic itself, right? Ostensibly, this is a magic show, right? That has been put on film. And magic has become, I think, in the postmodern age, a way to look at how we perceive, right? Because illusion is all about shaping a perception of something into something that it's not really. It is convincing you that you are seeing something differently than what is actually happening. And it's extraordinary to use magic in this way, because I think there are extraordinary magical effects, illusions in this performance, but it is very much not a magic show, not a traditional magic show. And it's not about the magic. It's about the storytelling, and it's about this notion of how we perceive ourselves, how we perceive each other, this sense of identity, and how we interact as human beings. And that is explored through storytelling. It is explored through magical storytelling. And I say magical storytelling in the abstract, right? Not in the, I'm an illusionist on stage, but in the idea of telling a story that is infused as, I mean, we were just talking about Star Wars, right? What I love about Star Wars is that it is a story infused with magic. It's space magic, but magic nonetheless, mm-hmm. right? That is why I am drawn to genre storytelling, because you can get at truths, you can examine the human condition through this layer of magic, this layer of the supernatural that allows you to break rules and do things and be more incisive and perceptive. And I think this in and of itself is a perfect example of that, a perfect example of using those tools in ways that are unexpected and beautiful. I was ugly crying throughout this. I mean, just my wife sitting next to me, I was just like heaving up and down because of how beautiful it was, because of how personal it was. I think it's an extraordinary work, and it's really well brought to film. The way that that Frank Oz, I assume, who had a lot to do with this, directed it, decided to use multiple performances to comment on the fact that this thing happens over and over again, right? The story, it continues. The notion of that book that is passed from person to person, the responsibility that people are given to take ownership of the tale themselves, it is such a powerful notion that we must participate in this telling, that we are given authorship and ownership over this telling. I found that to be so moving and so powerful, and so much about my worldview, how I engage with the world. I want to live that kind of life. That is why I want to be an artist. That is why I enjoy and consume art, is because of those things that it can make me feel and think and relate to my fellow man and bring forward, carry that burden along with us as a culture. And I just thought it spoke to all of that so eloquently, so beautifully. It is among my favorite things. I just thought it's an extraordinary piece of art.
All right. Devinder Hardwar, now that we're talking full spoilers for In and of Itself, mm-hmm. do you have any thoughts you want to share about it?
Yeah, I thought it was all right.
I'd give it a 5 out of 10.
It's good. Yeah, I think he did this thing pretty well. No, I can't really top what you're saying, Jeff. But I do. One thing I can say here is I think what works so well about it is, first of all, Derek Delgadio is an incredible storyteller. Like, as he just started leaning in with stories about the Ruletista and things like that, where I've seen a bunch of shows like this or similar types of like one man shows. I kind of know what I'm usually getting into, but his presence and his ability to weave a story, I think, is really phenomenal. Like, I could just sit down and listen to him and like tell me anything.
Yeah, you know? I was saying to Peter Cerretta, this is the first quote unquote magic show. I think describing it as a magic show is actually not accurate, right? It's like its own unique thing. But this is the first magic show where I was more interested in the patter than the magic. Like, I wanted to hear more of the storytelling, and the magic is good. You know, it's not bad.
The cards are incidental.
Yeah, but it's like I'm more interested in hearing like what you have to say about it. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. So, go ahead.
Which is amazing because actually doing, so few humans can do. You know, yet it's like marginal to the. It's kind of quite something.
It is it's quite the flex, right? Like it is it is purely a flex. But I definitely appreciate more of the storytelling aspects of it too. Like the magic looks cool, and I think the whole finale sequence where he's just reading off of the cards of how. I'm really racking my brain to figure out like how he pulls that one off. Like that's going to sit with me. But I think what's really compelling and why it's really triggering so many emotions in people, right, is that I think it is entirely devoted to being self-reflective and thinking about who you are and your identity and who you perceive yourself to be in the world, who you present yourself as, and how other people see you. And, you know, we're not a society that really is good about that. In a way, right? Like you have to go to, church, or you have to go to self-help people to really start thinking about those things, because in our capitalist society, it's all about like, what the hell am I doing today to live and to survive? And what is the president doing? What's going on? Oh, the virus is still here. Like we don't have time for this stuff most of the time. So I think it is fantastic to have something like this that's fully devoted to it. I try to practice that idea of being self-reflective and really thinking about what I'm bringing to the world and kind of who I am. And that informs a lot of what I do too. Like it is, for me, it's like not just about creating art or anything. It's a way of life. It's a way of living. And I think this totally just encapsulates that so well.
Drew McQueenie, curious what your thoughts are on In and of Itself.
I think magic is the way it's presented, especially on television, somewhat ossified, and it's a lot like stand-up comedy. I think there is a very easy, very safe way to present it, and you get familiar with it. So it's really hard to be surprised by how somebody can present magic or contextualize magic. And I think Delgadio's show is beautifully written, and I think what he's ultimately doing, and he makes it clear when he tells a story about the weight of a brick, that's a moment where I realized, oh my God, this is not at all what I thought I was getting into. Mm-hmm. There's a really different weight to this. And there's a really different level of personal presentation. I think most magicians keep you at arm's length because they need to have a persona that is somewhat mysterious and that allows them to sell you illusions and that allows them to con you. There's a lot that's going on in presentation where they're lying to you, right to your face. But his show is all about honesty, and it's all about laying bare elements of yourself that you are loath to share with people or that you think may not be seen by people. It's what makes the final trick so powerful. And, you know, the final trick, I'm sure there is a mechanism to it, to the way he can do the entire crowd every night and get it right. Of course there is. It's probably not radically different than the same techniques or the same basic techniques that are used by psychics who do cold readings of theaters. But what makes it so powerful and so wonderful is you are willing to, by that point in the show, he's earned your emotional connection. He's earned your investment in him pulling this trick off. And once you realize what he's doing, you realize he's going to go through the whole crowd, every person, and look them in the eye. That it gets bigger each time. And it becomes more of an emotional experience because everybody in the room starts to hold their breath. Can this really happen? Can he really get through all of us?
And I think it's even better than that, Drew. It's not the entire room. It's only the people that self-reveal that their label is how they really see themselves.
Yeah.
Which is such a beautiful frame for it. It's like, it's extraordinary. Yeah. It's a subset of the people who are here to tell the truth. It's amazing.
And then it becomes about the moment of looking somebody in the eye and taking that beat and saying, I see you.
Yeah.
I see you in particular. And I'm making this moment about you. And it one of the most devastating ones, it's fascinating because this guy is, in my mind, the epitome of a guy who I don't have an emotional connection to in his work, David Blaine. When we see David Blaine in the audience as one of the many people who goes by during this sequence, and Delgadio says, my brother.
Yeah.
Blaine's weeping.
Yeah.
Blaine's in tears as he sits down, and he's shaken by it. And I know Blaine can figure this trick out if he wants, but he's there because he wants to have the experience too. He wants, and to me, that's beautiful, man. That's an artist who he's all about. Of course, I'm going to go into that room and not sit there arms crossed, daring him to do it. I'm going to sit there wide open, hoping he does it. And yeah. When he does, it's like a fighter landing the perfect punch. Like, it's devastating. And I think the letter trick, the reason the scale of that tile, the name card trick at the end is so impressive is because it's all those people who've stood up and made that choice. What to me makes the letter trick so crazy is I can't for the life of me begin to pull apart how you would even begin to think about doing that trick. It's unfathomable. And I love it. I love the fact that I don't care. It works. It works repeatedly. And those emotional responses, those aren't actors. Those are people that you can see very clearly. Oz is so smart about, like you said, the montage of reaction, of letting us see it land again and again and watching different people. And I think the lady who says how.
Yeah.
And he just says, I know. It's the best moment because he's telling her, I get it. I just turned your brain inside out. Yeah, it's really happening. You're really having this experience.
Yeah.
And man, it's just gorgeous. It's a gorgeous emotional experience. My background is theater. That's where I started working. Most of my early work was theater. I went to college for theater. I love the immediacy of being in a room with 100 people, 150 people who are all dialed in emotionally to something that's happening on a stage. And I've seen it happen over and over with one acts, with drama, with comedy, with things like that. Magic rarely, to me, does the same emotional hook. It's more about the mechanical trick. And in the middle of the thing, when he's doing the dealing and you're just getting a sense of how nimble he is, all of that is technically radically impressive. He's terrific. He's got great close-up skills. And if you know close-up magic at all, dude's got wicked magic fingers. He lets you look directly at him doing shit he shouldn't be able to do and dares you to catch him doing it. But he knows that that stuff only goes so far. So it's basically thrown away in the middle of the show. It's really built around just a few big moments. And it's not like a typical magic show. It's not built around whether or not those illusions land. By the time you realize that the trick is underway, you're already just emotionally invested. It's really a remarkable film. And God bless Frank Oz, man. He shot, to me, it's as strong a document of a live production of something as Jonathan Demme Stop Making Sense. Mm-hmm.
Dave, a few weeks ago, you and I commented on a documentary called
Painter and the Thief.
And there was a moment in that we both were struck by, I think both moved by, where you see a camera holds on a face as it kind of goes through
one of the best moments this year.
Truly amazing.
Yeah.
I was reminded of that in the letter sequence when you know, as Drew so eloquently pointed out, that we see that transformation happen again and again and again and again. Not only that, but we're told ahead of time that's what's going to happen. He, Babe Ruth, calls his shot. He stands on the stage and points to the back row and says, "I'm hitting the ball over that fence." Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, so I don't mean to cut you off, Dave. I just wanted to connect with you over that, because I was reminded of that moment. I was like, you know, we commented about this exquisite human moment and how rare it is to see that on film. And then here he is. This guy was doing it every night in a theater 500 plus times. You know, it's like, oh man, wow.
Well, you know, guys, I'm going to be honest. I don't know how I should proceed as we wrap this up here, because you guys have been so eloquent and beautiful in how you've described the reaction to the show, your reaction to the show, and how incredible it is. I don't know if I want to fight with you about it.
Oh, you didn't like it?
No, it's not that I didn't like it. But first of all, Jeff, like, I love, and I know many of our listeners love when Jeff gets wound up about a show like this, because it's beautiful hearing you talk about it. It's like really, it's really incredible and inspiring, and I love it. I also don't like to be on the other end of it if I raise any disagreement at all with what you've said, which is unfortunately how I actually feel about the show, which is like, I think it's incredibly compelling, and I recommend it to anyone. You know, it's like, I'm going to be thinking about it for a really long time, but I'm much more mixed on, like, I feel much more mixed on it than you guys do. And it's really about, like, I you know, the way I'm going to describe it is...
What does this say about you? Let's deconstruct this.
Yeah. I mean, here, you know, I don't know. Like, this is the thing, is we could just end this right now. It could be a beautiful reflection. If we ended this right now, it would be this beautiful reflection in and of itself. And if I keep going, it could end on a much more sour note, you know? And I don't know if I want to do that.
I mean,
never stopped you before, Dave.
I would like to know more of what you think.
There is this, like, a couple of things. There's this quote that Jerry Seinfeld has, right? He says, "All magic is, here's a quarter, now it's gone. You're a jerk, now it's back. You're an idiot, show's over." That's Jerry Seinfeld on magic, right? And obviously he's exaggerating for comedic effect. But ultimately, right, that, like, all, like, magic in many ways is about, like, you're dumb. Like, I did this thing. You're stupid. Like, you didn't. And to be fair, I freaking love magic. Like, I dare say I'm probably a bigger magic fan than you guys. Like, I watch tons of shows.
I go toe to toe with you on that.
All right, that's fair. But, you know, like, I'm a huge, huge magic fan. Like, love watching shows. Love, like, following specific magicians. And so it's not like I don't like the art form at all. Like, I love it. And watching the show, I was super compelled by the storytelling, and it did make me rethink a lot of things. Like, the moment that I'm going to keep coming back to is the idea of he tells it as, I think it's like six blind men and an elephant or whatever, but it's like, I know it as three blind men and an elephant, right? Which is like, blind men, like, touch an elephant and they all think it's a different thing. And he's like, how did the elephant feel? Like, what if the elephant actually was all those things, and like, the elephant actually had, you know, legs that were trees, and, you know, but it's the people that were too close-minded to feel that way. And the whole shit, I was like, oh my gosh, what an amazing inversion of that story. That, like, I love the story of three blind men and an elephant, and then for this story to, like, take it and turn it on its head and make me, like, rethink that story in a new way is brilliant. I love it. But ultimately, you know, the show is incredibly manipulative, right? I mean, and the ending sequence that you guys are talking about. So first of all, I have information about how the letter stuff is done, if you guys would like to hear about it. Maybe you don't, and that's fine. But the ending thing where he's like, goes around and see, you know, he sees all these people. Drew, I think you captured it quite beautifully. Like, people can know how it's done or can figure it out how it's done, but, like, the impact still lands the same. When I watch it, though, I'm like, you know, like, this guy is being incredibly manipulative, right? He's saying, it's this moment of, he's saying, like, I see you, right? Like, he's looking at people and saying, like, I see you for who you see you are. Of course, like, he figured out a way to track what they actually picked off the board, and he either memorized it or it's being fed into him by some earpiece or something, or people are signaling to him, whatever the way it is, there might be some kind of trick to it. And in an interview he gave for Vanity Fair, the question was asked to him, there's a dawning realization that audiences are having a strong emotional reaction to your work and that you needed to bear that responsibility in mind. So in the spirit of Dog versus Wolf, do you ever feel a bit like a wolf? This is the question, the interview question asked him. And he says, quote, it's actually the opposite. If anything, I'd get a little upset if they weren't accepting the gift I was trying to give them. Almost everyone, with very few exceptions, took things as intended, but I've always said that I'll break into your house to leave you the thing you've always wanted. I'm putting people in a position where they're forced to be a little vulnerable in front of strangers, but at the same time, the gifts that they're being given, the gift of being seen and heard and acknowledged, I'll become the villain if that's the thing I'm dishing out, end quote. And this thanks to Scott from the Slack Filmcast and listener for sending this to me. But that's kind of how I feel about it. I do think he's kind of the villain, and I don't like him for that. And some people might find his breaking into your house to leave them the thing they want, like, some people might find that useful, and I see it as a guy who's breaking into some person's house.
You know? I genuinely have a hard time understanding how you can get to that position, because he's not breaking into anybody's house. They are entering the magic circle, right? They've walked into a theater and entered into a tacit contract with the performer that says, hey, I'm here for something. I've paid you money to do this. I have paid you money to give me an experience. So he's not taking anything from anybody. He is using the information that they have given him willfully. They walked to a board and self-selected a noun that describes them or doesn't. Then he asks anybody who feels like that noun is accurate to self-select, to stand up and participate. How is he breaking into anybody's house?
Okay, I mean, you're disagreeing with his own assessment of what he's doing then. I mean,
no, I'm saying, what I took from that quote was that he said, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to give an experience to someone. And I have a hard time understanding your position as to how that sours the experience in this particular case.
Well, he is asking more from the audience than I would say the vast majorities of shows ask from their audience. Like, I've seen, I've been to theaters dozens, maybe hundreds of times. And like, if I went to this show, it would be asking for more from me than any show I've ever been to in my entire life.
Oh, right? He throws a guy out and then tells you have to come back tomorrow night. I mean, that's a wild one. I think that's, and then there's a homework assignment that's part of that I would love to get an hour with that book just to look at it.
Yeah, that would be amazing. I agree.
What a thing. Again, self-selected. He's not forcing it on anybody. And I don't know. He asks more of his audience than most, but that's the rules of his magic circle, right? That magic circle is this notion that as we enter into a game or a piece of theater or any set aside circumstance where we have left the real world and established a new set of rules. If you play a game of tag, right? If I run up to you and tag you in the real world, what the fuck is that? That's not anything, but we have decided to establish a magic circle wherein if I tag you, you have to tag me, and that's the rules. And so now all of the rules of the outside world are no longer valid. The rules inside our magic circle are the only thing that are valid. That's what happens when you walk into a theater. And he has defined those rules, his magic circle's rules, as such, and he asks the audience, he doesn't force them, he asks them at every step to participate, to come and accept those rules. And at no point does he force anything on anybody. I guess I bristle at the notion that it is somehow.
I knew you'd bristle, and I mean, I think that the point I'm making is that he's asking his audience to bleed, right? Like, he's asking them to expose themselves and make them themselves more vulnerable than probably literally any other show that they've ever been to. And you might say, oh, well, that's part of the contract. Of course, you would know that. And I'm like, no, I don't think so, Jeff. I don't,
if you went to that show,
they would know going in there.
And if you went to that show and you selected a card from the wall before you walked in that revealed something about you that you didn't want revealed to the rest of the people in that room, all you have to do is stay seated.
Mm-hmm. It's true. That's not the only part that is in question, right? And so you're right about that. You're right. People could like sit down in advance and so on, right? Like it's very true. I will acknowledge that. But like the people who get the letters, you know, that's not something that they necessarily know is going to hit them in that way. I understand they volunteer, but it's just like, this is not a situation where it's like, hey, the duck is in the container and you get like people can see you react to it. You know what I'm saying? It's like it's a much different, more exposed place that he's putting these people into. And it makes it more real. It makes it incredibly watchable and compelling. But I also can't deny that I feel a little dirty watching it. Like, I feel like I'm watching people that were kind of put in this situation. And, you know, I'm sure they don't, like, I don't get the sense that they have deep regrets about it. Like, everyone is dazzled by this thing. Everyone loves this thing. But to me, it feels like that we're watching kind of these people expose themselves under the false pretenses that are inherent to a magic show. So it's not like I hated it. I'm not like saying like, don't watch it. Quite the opposite. I'm telling everyone I know to watch it. I think it's really interesting.
I don't mean to argue with you. I think it's a valid take. What I saw in each of those instances was him leaning in and whispering, asking permission for the person to, are you comfortable reading this out loud? I saw that moment happen. At no point does he force anyone to do anything they don't want to do, to what I saw, but maybe I missed something.
Well, it's not that, I mean, I would agree with you. I saw that moment as well, but like the person is already in that situation to begin with. Like, They got up there not knowing they're about to get hit by an emotional freight train. And this is theoretically a magic show, you know, or a one-person show. So I just don't think that that's something they could... Anyway, I don't think I'm going to get much sympathy from my point of view.
Let me also point out here, this was a pretty exclusive show. It was really hard to get into.
You got to be Bill Gates to get into that show.
Yeah, Bill Gates. You should have an inkle of what was happening. Maybe not like the full spoilage, but I think a lot of people know.
You're saying people
to go in and like brace yourself.
To some degree, knew probably what they were getting into. Right?
This is self-selecting to a really high degree here. Yeah.
So, you know, I think I don't disagree with a lot of what you guys are saying. I just like, I had different reactions. I had reactions on top of the reactions you guys had to it. Drew, I'm curious if you had is any of what I'm saying resonating with you at all? Or are you kind of like Jeff, you're like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
No, I can see what you're saying. And I do think it's a big emotional ask. It's not at all what you think you're going to get when you turn on a magic show. And part of telling people, like I did this on Twitter yesterday, I think I said, when you watch it, don't read anything and just turn your phone off, give it your full attention and let it do what it's doing. And I think it's a big emotional ask for even just a passive audience, not even the active audience. It's not a light thing. I think the story he tells about his mother is a heavy story that doesn't have an easy moral out at the end of it. He's not the hero of that story. He's not telling you a story that's designed to be like, and then I did the exact right thing and everything was awesome. It's kind of shameful what he does. And it's a very real thing that I think he probably carried around for a long time and then built into this piece of art that he's doing. Mm-hmm. I think he does that because he's letting you know that he's willing to bleed. Mm. He's going to ask some big things of his audience.
That kind of redeemed it for me is like he is bleeding for the audience and he's kind of asking for the same thing, right?
But to me, that's the trade. It's not a one-way transaction. And I think a lot of magic shows are a one-way transaction where somebody's hand is in your pocket. And at the end of it, you're right. It's the, you're stupid. And look, I've got your underwear and you don't even know that I got it. And it's, well, how did that happen? And there's an element of you looking foolish. I don't think these people look foolish. I think these people are revealing something human, and in a way, it makes it feel... I was talking earlier today to my girlfriend about... I was listening to a music playlist in the car, and I had The playing. And I told her in my top five show of all time for me. And I went in not to see them. I went in to see the other act that was playing that night. And she asked, well, why then, what made it a top five show? And I said, it was the fact that every single song felt like it was emotionally picked to do something to you sitting in the audience, not just to do something, not just a, okay, these are the hits or these, what, but it felt like there was a carefully considered emotional experience that had been curated and designed to punch a hole in you. And I didn't know that band at all, but I walked away totally impressed and totally moved by the experience. And Delgadian was the same way. I don't know his work. I didn't know at all what I was getting into. And I hadn't really read about it. I just knew that it was something that Frank Oz had directed. I knew that it was a magic show that was unconventional in presentation and that it was a one-man show. And so I didn't know what I was getting into. And I was really taken by it. And yeah. I do think it's a big ask. I don't think it's an easy, simple thing. And it's not making the Statue of Liberty disappear. That's not the kind of thing you're getting into.
Right. I have a couple quick thoughts on what you said. First of all, like, you're right. I don't think these people look foolish, you know? Like, I think it's incredibly powerful when you see what these people go through at the end. But at the end of the day, it still is a thing where he's fooling people. You know what I mean? Like, he is still pulling one. It's inherent to the structure of what is going on. And so that's kind of the component that rubbed me the wrong way. I also want to read this comment from Jason in the Slack Filmcast. And this isn't quite my reaction to it, but it's like in the same vein. Jason says, I watched this and it made me feel physically ill. All I could think of is how he's basically performing the snake oil tricks of a faith healer and using people's real emotion as part of his magic trick show. I imagine this comes from my religious background in history, but the way he manipulated those people made me feel really sick and reminded me of many religious retreats I've been on. Even his way of pausing and using silence was like many sermons I've seen. I understand he's not necessarily or intentionally using those powers for evil as some do, but you could argue similar things about some faith healers or people who contact your dead relatives on your behalf, all of which does something that does sometimes make those people feel good for a bit. At the very least, I'd say if this moved you, maybe take a minute and rethink your perspective on people who are tricked by faith healers or who are extremely zealous in some extremely some seemingly inexplicable churches, cults, etc. Because this was, I think, a pretty fantastic demonstration of how all those things work. End quote.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and yeah. I don't think he would argue with that. I don't think he would disagree with you that it is a demonstration of those things, but I think it's ultimately in what way does it land? But yeah, he tells you right at the beginning that he's going to lie to you and trick you. And here's why I don't think it's just a cheap trick, though, because, yeah, there's a mechanism to him being able to pair every person with the card that they pulled off the wall. There is a built-in trick. There's some part of that selection process and how it's filmed and how it's sure, of course, we all know that. Rationally, you know that. But even so, it's not a dishonest thing to when he says it to you, he looks at you for a moment. When he says the thing to you, I don't even think there's a trick element to that. I think by saying it, he's confirming for you, this is what you think of yourself, and I'm saying it back to you now, and I'm confirming it. So
yeah, he is experiencing the emotion.
They've given him permission to do it.
Yeah.
Yes. They've given him permission to do it. He's not taking some information that they are hiding from the world and using it for his personal gain. Right? This is information.
I mean,
it is by definition
for his personal gain. Like, it is a show in which he is profiting from, right? So
Well, he got that money far before he did that move.
Sure,
but
sure.
I think honestly, what I took from it is that his goal in that moment, if there's a trick that's happening, the trick is to, force people to feel a connection with each other in a way they didn't think they were going to. Right. And, you know, we've talked, I think, a bit about Frank Oz and his, I think, really stellar work here in transitioning this to a film, because ultimately this is the kind of thing that people go into a room together and experience and leave that room changed and feeling closer to one another. Right. This is this kind of thing that happens in a room. to be able to express that same kind of feeling, or at least it was for me, through a screen and not being in that room, to give me the feeling that I was in that room with those people, and not just with those people, but with numerous iterations of those people as portrayed by the film.
Right.
I think is really not easy. And I think that to me is the raison d'etre of this entire show is, hey, okay, maybe I'm going to use illusion. I'm going to use storytelling. I'm going to use lies or whatever you want to call it. I mean, any movie lies to you. Any movie tricks you. Any movie manipulates you with camera moves and music cues. If you want to be, you know, reductive about it, they're all lies to get you to feel something. And that ultimately is the only thing happening here, is he is using the tools that he has available to have people feel something. And the thing that they feel, I think, is a sense of connection to one another and their fellow humans. And I find it, I mean, with all due respect to the Slack film post, it seems very, a very different example. I mean, obviously I'm defending it, but I don't think it's as malicious as all that. Mm-hmm. Ultimately it is a piece whose entire purpose is there to make you examine yourself in the context of other people. And at every step of the way, he allows people to not participate. So it just doesn't feel malicious to me in any stretch. So that's
all right. Well, I'm glad you let me articulate some of my viewpoints on this, Jeff. I know this has deeply moved you, and it deeply moved me as well. I mean, that's a fact. I just was left feeling quite ambivalent about it. And I think my opinion is the very, very far minority. I think like 80 to 90% of the people who watch this thing love it without reservation. I have some reservations, and appreciate if you're listening to this right now and you watch the show, like, appreciate you out there. Appreciate you guys on the podcast listening to my concerns and considering them as well. So whatever our thoughts are about it, though, we can all agree it is an incredibly provocative piece of work, and I think it's worth watching. So check it out. It's Derek Delgadio's In and of Itself. Let's end it there. I do want to call out that Drew McWeeny's browser crashed and he is no longer with us. So we lost Drew McWeeny, but do check out Drew's newsletter, Formerly Dangerous, at drewmcweeny.substack.com. It's awesome, and we really appreciate him sticking around for this part of the show.
98% well. Of the show.
98% of the show.
He really almost made it.
He almost made it to the end. He went the distance with us. Yeah. And thank you over there at patreon.com/filmcast, film podcast, for making episodes like this possible. We will see you next week.